kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, Tide number 104, with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Di Barnes. Good evening, Doug. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Di. How are you doing?
I'm good. We're in the last, so after this weekend will be the last 2 weeks of term because we're a boarding school, so we're kind of, our term finishes nice and early. So it's all about planning for next year, really, and that kind of thing, exams, marking exams, reports will come shortly after that, and all the end of term celebrations that come with the end of the school year. So
we've got like a couple of months off after that?
Yes, exactly that.
Very nice. Are you going anywhere, doing anything?
I have no plans as of yet. So I might, I'm going to Munich for a couple of days towards the end of the holiday, and I'm thinking of learning to play the accordion. And
the accordion?
Yeah.
What's brought that up?
I just think it would be interesting and to use to record in music. To be able to make different sounds than I can with my guitar. Mm-hmm. And then I might go to America.
I was going
to
make some kind of lame joke there about expanding your repertoire, but I won't.
Oh, you are a squeeze, hey?
No.
And yeah, so I might go to Idaho for a month as well.
Why, for some kind of hoedown or...?
With my accordion, yeah. My old friend of mine emigrated there 18 months ago, and I promised to visit him, and since I've got nothing on this summer, I could just go this summer. Although I saw a news report claiming we're going to have 3 months of nice weather in this country, so...
Oh, very good.
Not in a particular rush to, you know, go further afield. But Idaho sounds quite exciting. So I have relatives not far from there in Oregon as well, so I might go and see them.
Good.
Yes, but other than that, so in the week I've been, what have I been doing? I've been doing drugs training, which is yesterday. So I spent the day with, this gentleman came in from a company called Drugs Training. Their Twitter handle is linked to in the show notes. And it was really, really interesting finding out about all the synthetic, drugs that are sort of unclassified and therefore not illegal. Are built to replicate the effects of standard sort of six or seven drugs that are out there that are categorized, and how they can't be tested for, and what's going on in that kind of culture, and what we need to be aware of as carers of young people, which was absolutely fascinating, and everyone should know more about it, to be honest. And the synthetic drugs are really cheap. And very accessible, and they're very hard to pick up on. You can't see them, sort of thing. And it did sort of emphasize to me the idea that we're going to be moving towards drugs. This is what I think will ultimately happen, is they'll move towards, because like Canada is about to legalize cannabis, for example, as they've done in Colorado and elsewhere in America, and it has been the case in Holland and Amsterdam for a long time. And so in the festivals this year, so every festival this summer will have in it a tent where you can take your drugs to be tested for their purity and strength.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, so it's things are changing. So no, more people die from the use of illegal drugs than ever before. So drugs is a worse, you know, the problem is worse than it's ever been, and it's to do with drugs being created. Massive amounts are created in China, apparently. MDMA particularly, and the big issue, MDMA is a big killer, and the problem with it is that it comes in crystal form, so people are just consuming it, but it's actually very, very pure, like 94% pure or something like that, and it's far too pure, basically, so people are taking too much of it. So they have two little campaigns are out there at the moment. One is don't be daft, just take half, and the other one is crush, dab, wait. So the idea that you crush your crystals, dab a bit on your finger and taste your drug, and wait for 45 minutes at least, or an hour, and to see what impact that is having on your body, to see if it's okay for you to take more. Interesting stuff about how to, you know, the whole idea with these things is how to educate people. People are going to take drugs, so if they are going to take drugs, how do we help them to do it safely rather than just say you're breaking the law? Fascinating conversation and a sort of difficult one. We have to work out what's going on in our school in that regard, and it's quite hard. I think the kids are pretty well behaved in that regard here, but we still need to be on top of it. So it was fascinating, to be honest. But he did say, it was really interesting, there was this, he talked about students at Oxford, I think it was, using drugs to be able to study more. And this drug out there called modafinil, I think it's called, M-O-D-A-F-I-L.
Isn't that the one Obama used?
Well, quite possibly. But it has very few side effects, headaches, stomach ache, but not severe. Just get them and things like that. Obviously, it can impact on your sleep and things. But you're supposed to take it in the morning. It's a was prescribed for narcolepsy, so it's not an illegal drug. And so this guy claimed that the use of this was rife in universities. But I saw an article this morning, just by coincidence, that this was not the case anymore. So the one that was saying that it was being had been done loads was an NUS, a National Union of Students survey. And in this YouTube clip he showed us, it's actually an Oxford professor, one of the teachers, was saying, yeah, he uses it. It's really helpful. I mean, it's not a silver bullet. It doesn't make you anything, but it can be helpful if you've got a lot of work to do in a particular period of time. But so they were saying that this BBC one says it's less than it was less prevalent than they thought. And it's about 31% of students are using it, sort of thing. But if I've had a chat on Twitter with one of my former students who's at Newcastle University now studying computer science. And he was, so I asked him, when I tweeted this article out, he replied. So I asked him what he did, and he said, well, he says students don't have any money. I don't understand why you think they can afford these drugs. And he said they just consume loads of energy drinks. But I would argue that some of the energy drinks are full of as much crap as any drug, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there might be taurine and stuff in there, yeah.
Yeah, and cause basic side effects as well, which are not welcome, really. So... it's an interesting concept. If you think there's this drug out there that is not going to give you many side effects and is going to help you get your stuff done, so one of the people in the room said it was cheating if they did that. And I just said, no, it's not. It's just a daft thing to say. It's like, if you eat a healthy diet, are you cheating because it makes your brain work better? If you eat more fish, sort of thing, just because it's a chemical.
Right, but there's a reason why, and I think this is fascinating when it comes to sports as well. Like, there's guidelines in terms of sport, like what counts as doping and cheating and stuff, and what's legitimate.
Yeah, but it's. I think that's a scale, that's a spectrum. It's not a definition, and I think that's the sort of thing they struggle with. And you look at Chris Froome and Bradley Wiggins and the asthma drugs. It's amazing that these two asthmatic men are the finest cyclists ever in the world, allegedly, or something. But their stuff's yet to come out. But a colleague of mine at my former school called Ronnie Mashisho was best man to Mo Farah at his wedding. And also a sportsman himself, a very, very lovely man. And he was quite convinced that everybody competing at high-level sports were adapting the substances that they consumed to improve their performance and rehabilitation post-training and their recovery, basically. And what you called... how you define doping is really, really quite difficult, and it's a very gray area, and it's just a matter of, like, Usain Bolt and people like that, they were just very confident that it was a matter of when they get caught for doping, not if they got caught for it. It was quite interesting, and they were very confident about that principle, and they were sports scientists and, you know, done all of that kind of thing and worked in the industry, as it were. So
yeah, I mean, I take 4 tablets every morning, so I can't kind of complain.
Yeah, and if you start to look, you know, at the end of the day, if you're looking at vitamins, vitamins aren't all just, is it just another way of consuming plants? You know, how do you define what a chemical is? How do you define what an unfair advantage is the thing. And certainly in elite sports, you'd expect there to be some doping and that kind of thing, and other possible industries, but not in undergraduate study. And so if people
if you can't cope with undergraduate life without drugs. Okay.
That would be my worry is, I also read this article as well this week about where someone used, I think we can talk about it actually, it's a Zuckerberg Follies article, I think it's in there, where they, rather than talking about addiction or compulsive behavior, they talk about habituated behavior. And this is in relation to technology and how people, how technology, and I thought it was really, really sensible way to discuss it. So rather than saying the word addict and all that kind of thing, that you talk about an habituated behavior and that it was a bad habit of being very cleanly and clearly formed and it needs to be broken. You know, and I thought that was a good idea. Anyway.
Mm, no, definitely.
That was the last 24 hours, more or less.
You put something here about a computer science conversation.
All right, yes. All right, so this morning, I think Miles Berry was having a conversation with someone about computer science and the quality of computer science. And I just piped in a little bit. I think it was John Torbett. He works at Rendcomb School, I think. Computer science teacher. He said that the problem with the quality of the GCSE, which has been under national scrutiny in press this year, GCSE computer science across all the boards, to do with the non-examined assessments, the NEAs, which were the controlled assessments, and they got withdrawn and they're no longer marked. So you have to do them and you have to show that the children have spent 20 hours of supervised classroom time doing this work. But then all of a sudden they decided that there were too many answers to the questions that were only released on the 1st of September out on the internet. And therefore they canned the whole lot. And now you just have to prove that they've been done, but they're not moderated, they're not marked, as it were. Anyway, so that's a big blow for the subject at Key Stage 4, in my opinion. Mm. Especially when they spent so much effort with a specification that's only examined for the first time this summer, two or three weeks ago. You want the integrity of the subject to be to just improve each iteration of its specification, and because it was in under massive national scrutiny before this was written, this specification was written, I was hoping it was going to be okay. And it is a really, really amazing piece of work they do, the NEA. I think it's the best piece of work they do at that age level, across all the subjects. And but unfortunately, this, again, it's in national scandal. What this does is undermines the integrity of the subject moving forwards. So therefore, at A level, and therefore as a facilitating subject at university, which means that universities will want a hard subject, they're called, the ones that they, let's say, for computer science, the hard subject is maths. And there are only 10 hard subjects, despite the fact there are many different A levels. So even if you're going to study A level architecture at university, architecture at A level won't help you. That's not what they'll be after. And computer science is in a similar boat. So I have four A star predicted computer science A level students who are exceptional, each of them, and three of them are applying for computer science degrees. Two of them require A stars in maths, but not the A stars in computer science are no good to them. So they will. So they won't be pushing to get the A star in my subject because their universities aren't interested in that for them.
So who defines these 10? Is this a ubiquitous thing, or is it some universities declaring that some subjects are, the 10 hardest?
This is guidance from, I don't know off the top of my head what the organization that manages university applications is, unless it's UCAS, but these are the 10 subjects that are the hard subjects for universities. Because there has to be consistency across the UCAS process, the application to university process, which is done through one portal in our country. And so I'm assuming it's them that are deciding what these are. But they will be working with universities and getting agreement for these things. So it's about establishing which qualifications have the right integrity, I guess, to mean if you get an A in that subject, you are this good at academic work. Yeah, so I'm guessing that's what it's about. So that's what my complaint was anyway. It was about the fact that there is a disconnect between the different stages of education, sort of, Key Stage 4 to Key Stage 5 to university. And So the outcome of that conversation was, so quite a few people got involved, and the outcome was a sort of call to incorporate computer science into the science family. So you have your biology, chemistry, physics, and computer science. You make it four rather than three sciences, and that the overlaps that would occur once you started that process, the overlaps that would occur between the subjects would eliminate dead content and drive the curriculum forwards in a sort of dynamic and helpful way. And certainly my impression of that, so a colleague of mine took half a dozen of his lower six down to Imperial College last academic year to see the graduates' exhibitions. So I think it was 200 pupils with 100 different projects, and 90% of those projects involved computer coding of some sort. Mm. And so what he came away from that thinking was, you cannot be a physicist without being a coder, without being a computer scientist. And in this day and age, and I would argue that's the case for many, many different disciplines, many different industries, definitely.
I've just looked up, because I was really interested in those subjects. And it's actually eight from what I can gather, and it's the Russell Group of Universities. So if you're outside the UK or you haven't been involved in UK higher education from anything other than the kind of consumer end as a student, the Russell Group Universities are the ones which existed as universities before 1992, when the former polytechnics were made into the new universities. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Russell Group Universities, I'll put the link there in the show notes. It says, some advanced level subjects are more frequently required for entry to degree courses than others. We call these subjects facilitating subjects because choosing them at advanced level leaves open a wide range of options for university study. These facilitating subjects are biology, chemistry, English literature, geography, history, physics, modern and classical languages, and maths and further maths.
Yes, so I would expand that. So economics, for example, is also in there, and I've read this page before, and if you download the PDF that's at the bottom, I think, mm-hmm. it will talk about economics being acceptable for economics degrees, and there's another one as well, I think, although...
Mm. Well, the interesting thing for me is that I took four of those eight at A-level.
Well, yes, so the point being is that for all the peripheral subjects, as one might call them, mine being one of those, you just wouldn't take them. If they're not in that list, you just wouldn't take it. That's the issue.
Right. So... And so computer science, even though it's available at A-level, just like philosophy is available at A-level, universities say that you should start doing computer science at university or philosophy at university as well?
Well, the issue with that is I would argue, so I send my students away to university and they'll get there to their first year, and a lot of people will have to learn the stuff that they know already. I don't get many students who aren't very able mathematicians who go through, but they will study maths. I haven't had one that hasn't.
So what happens to those students who kick ass at computer science after, you know, being at your school? They don't get to skip a year. Like, they have to sit through that basic stuff again.
Well, yes. So when you go to your first year at university, generally speaking, it'll be modular, and you will choose, there will be certain compulsory modules and certain choices that you can make. And obviously you don't have to make certain choices. And what you will want to see from a university, so if you're going to do a biology degree, for example, you will get a computer science module that will be taught by the computer science department, but you'll be able to opt for that module. It won't be compulsory. And the same is true. I've spoken to a physicist at Cambridge, for example, and the same is true of him as well. And the issue with it is what are the compulsory modules in that first year? And if they're just regurgitating A-level content, then they're kind of screwed.
Well, you see, this brings me back to all the stuff we've done around kind of competency-based education and all that kind of stuff. So even when I was at university, which is, you know, I graduated, 16 years ago, it was a modular-based system, just as it would have been before that time, where you could, and at that time, I was paying to go to university, so the start of kind of students as consumers. And you could choose within particular parameters which modules you'd do, and you could choose in the first year to do up to 50% of your modules in a different department and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the other side of that, the stuff that happens, especially in the US around the unbundling conversation, is that, oh, well, you should just be able to pick and mix. You should be able to choose. You should be able to get a module from this university, a module from another university. And certainly the early rhetoric around open badges was like that. Now, I am a bit more, I guess, conservative. I guess I would have been, having been through the system. I want there to be kind of a corpus. I want there to be something that if you did philosophy or economics or whatever it was at university, like you've got something in common and you, mm-hmm. you know definitely this stuff or this approach or whatever it is. I wouldn't want it to be like a all-you-can-eat buffet of whatever it is you want to grab and packaged up somehow in some kind of
Agreed.
Degree container.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting as well because somewhere along the line, there have to be, you imagine there to be bastions of your subject, of your discipline, you know what I mean? And and people who are protecting it. These different sort of levels of education at some point need to be stitched together properly, I think. And I have absolutely no doubt that anybody who has studied a computer science A level and goes to university to study computer science some more, although there will probably be wrongs, bad habits or whatever that the university would want them to unlearn in their programming, they will have a definite understanding of networking and how computers work down to the very, to the one process of a fetch, decode, and execute cycle. And but they would also, in their programming ability, they'd be quite agile by the time they got to university and quite familiar with the idea of coding and that kind of thing. Mm. However, you wouldn't go and study a computer science degree if you hadn't done some programming all by yourself and had an interest in that, even though you might not have studied it as a qualification at school. And I think that's the transition that we're at, really. So computer science and computational literacy, which we discussed last week, I think, needs to come on board. And that's what the move towards computing or computer science is at key stages 1, 2, 3, and 4, as standardized or whatever, you know.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because you just mentioned there that a lot of people, if they haven't come from doing computer science at school, have done some programming by themselves. Well, there's nothing like picking up bad habits by being self-taught, I guess.
Well, there is that, but no one is truly self-taught because, you know, everyone's building on the shoulders of somebody else, and so they might be poorly taught, but they will have bad habits. And if you're switching between languages, your habits become very different. So, you know, we make sure that our students have hit at least three languages from our point of view, but from their point of view, we encourage them to go and explore a language on their own, particularly if they're very talented in the subject. Is how we present challenge. It's like, okay, you're going to go and code this, but you're going to do it in a language you've never used before and that we can't support them in. So they're really out there in the wilderness, really, with very little scaffolding from us, although we're very supportive of them doing it. But we can't help them because it's not a language that we're familiar with. And I think that working across languages stops you having bad habits and allows you to make choices about which language you think is the right one for you, I guess.
Because I guess it's a bit like spoken languages in the sense that it gives you a different approach to the world and a different way of describing reality as you see it.
Mm. Yeah. I think they are like different languages, really. But to be honest, transitions between languages are very simple. You just got to remember some very clean principles about how things work. And as ever, people will be looking stuff up as they're programming, how to do things as they're programming, and getting help from those that have gone before them, you know. Anyway, it was an interesting conversation. So this move of computer science into science, anyway, and folding it into that that family of subjects, it seems like quite a sensible move, and a way to address the shortage of computer science teachers, possibly. So physicists, I know, are often quite good with computers, I thought it was quite exciting, really, and worth exploring, although I didn't really want to get involved too much myself, just because I've got a job, and it doesn't really excite me, but I think it was quite exciting in itself.
Cool. Yeah. Well, at the same time as reading about kind of how integrated and evil and comprehensive Amazon's approach to dominating the world is, I bought three Amazon Fire HD 8 tablets this week because they're on special offer on Amazon. And the reason I bought them is because my kid. So long conversation. Those who have listened to Tide for a long time will know that I have had many different struggles and approaches and whatever with my family's technology, including confiscating my son's smartphone. And it seems that the world is a better place when they have, both my kids have tablets, which they don't have the passwords for, and which they can then use on my or their parents' terms, which sounds very draconian and not at all what I was expecting to do as a parent. But, you know, them's the things. So I bought these three tablets because I want to read more stuff. And I've actually rearranged an area of my house to be more of a reading-friendly kind of space. And so I bought this Fire tablet because I want to read more stuff on a tablet, you know, PDFs, Kindle books, whatever. Mm-hmm. My e-reader, even though it's wonderful and open source and stuff, isn't getting updates anymore. So I'm going to have to transition out of that. Anyway, so these ones, special offer, they were refurbished, etc. And I bought three of them. They arrived today. I'm going to be configuring them for the journey that we're going on, the two-week journey around Europe. The idea being that they can listen to audiobooks, read books, watch films, etc. during the long train journeys, as well as looking out the window. So I have been configuring these Amazon tablets. Now, as you'd expect, I'm not just going to take the Amazon tablets the way that they are. I'm going to try and hack them a bit. First thing to do is to hack the screensavers that appear when you have them turned on the lock screen, mm-hmm. which you can do by using ADB, which is Android Debug Bridge, because Fire OS is built on Android. And the second thing is that if you allow in the Fire OS settings APK files to be installed from anywhere, you can install FDroid, which is an open source repository of apps. And inside there, there's something called Yalp. And I don't know what Yalp stands for, Y-A-L-P. But you can install that via FDroid. And once you've done that, you can download apps from the Google Play Store without a Google account. So all that sounds a bit complicated, but basically all you're doing is downloading FDroid, downloading Yalp, and then picking and choosing what you want to install. And it's very, very easy, and you don't have to what's called root the tablet. So I'm currently doing that and figuring out ways I can use the inbuilt Amazon features to limit my kids' stuff in a way which is not surveilling them, which isn't kind of constraining them too much, but also, you know, giving them time to do all of their sports and reading and other stuff.
Okay. Well, that should be interesting to see how you get on with them and if it solves your problem or not. I had an interesting pastoral issue today. So a boy was sent to me for the second time this year, and he's in year 9. He joined the school a year before, but this is his first year in his normal boarding house. And he's in trouble for being on the internet too much and watching YouTube and gaming and stuff. And his housemaster is very concerned. So he came to see me again to get his sanction and to discuss more what he'd been doing. And he'd actually done something in a lesson, and I was really annoyed with him. So it was quite an interesting idea. So he's in a DT lesson, and the teacher was sending the children to different parts of the department. So he was giving them a certain sense of independence and freedom in their study and trusting them to get on with their work. And when he came to check on this individual, he had typed something he shouldn't into the internet browser. He hadn't pressed enter, but he'd typed it. And so I talked to him about trust and how he'd broken that trust that the teacher had given him. And I sort of talked to him about what kind of school do you want to be in? Do you want to be in a school where teachers have the confidence to have a diverse lesson like that and give you autonomy and freedom in your learning in some way? Or do you want to be in a school where you have to have eyes on you all of the time and be supervised all of the time? I know what kind of school I want to work in. What do you want? Kind of thing. We had that conversation. But then we talked more or less about his internet usage. I asked him about his home life and things like that. And he said at home, he's only allowed a very strict 1.5 hours a day of screen time. That's television, computers, or gaming. So that's what he does. Mm-hmm. So on his TV is his Xbox, whatever. And he has a 9-year-old little brother, a 17-year-old sister. He's 13 or 14. And he's only allowed to play games that are within age certification within Europe, for him, which is 16. Games are categorized as 16, so he's still not playing games like that. And he has to play things, because he usually plays with his little brother, and he has to play things that are good for him too. And I thought, ah, right, so when you get to school and you're in the boarding house, you're essentially like a kid in a sweet shop.
Going nuts, yeah.
Yeah, because you have this free access to it. And essentially what is happening, so I'd had this discussion with his housemaster beforehand. I said, because he was talking about, let's put him into internet quarantine where he has no access to the internet via our services, and confiscate his phone until the end of term. And I was like, I get why you're saying that, and I understand that, but we have to, so... only if the child is actually causing harm to themselves do we need to take that sort of drastic action, because what we're doing is essentially locking him out of the things, and what we're not doing is educating him about what's going wrong, unless we're using it as a punctuation point in his wider education.
Right.
And so I was discussing this with him, and so I was discussing these principles with him about what it is that what would be good for him, what, you know, he needed to learn. He needed to show people that he was in control at all times, and that he wasn't developing this habitual behavior and that kind of thing. And it was quite interesting. But as soon as he said, oh, well, I only get an hour and a half, I'm only allowed an hour and a half every day, each day. I thought, okay, well, of course you want to be able to go and just flick through YouTube randomly and to game for hours on end. Why would you not, as a person of your age, and school is where you can do it, so that's where you're doing it. So it's just quite interesting. And then the perception of screen time being really, really bad, and yet the entertainment that you can receive through these things being so absolutely fabulous. I just thought it wasn't clear.
Well, it's a difficult situation to be in, because I totally agree in principle with what you're saying there. But on the other hand, to get to the stage where, you know, there's a certain amount of YouTube, like if I let my son loose on YouTube for a weekend with unfettered access, he would watch 10 hours probably of YouTube videos, as would anyone his age, I'm guessing. And then he might get out of his system and come back to the other side. There is no way I'm going to ever let him do that.
Did you do that?
Well, there wasn't...
Did you do that in equivalence? That it wasn't the same
thing? Yeah, maybe as a 15-year-old.
Sorry?
Maybe like as a 15-year-old.
Yeah. So that's kind of my point, really. I think it's quite interesting is that you get a lot of... And I sympathize with you. And I've had a kid who gamed in extremis. Of my own, which was really, really hard to deal with. But we had a very sort of liberal policy generally. I mean, the internet, you know, so my youngest is 20 now, so this is back, nearly 10 years ago. I think it's a difficult thing to work out, but what I tend to think from having seen so many children go through my life, as it were, pass through my life, and then knowing them in adulthood, is that people go through this stuff, and it's not as bad as people think. Like, the consequences of it aren't as bad as people think. But as long as the child is accountable as a person for their behavior in their situations, and they're meeting what needs to be met to function in a family, then things are all right. Having said that, I know that your experience with Ben, when you got him off his device, that he was reading more, that he's more present in his conversations and in his relationships and all of that. I know my cousin has two boys, and she's taken their device. When they come to her house, she's separated from their dad. When they come to her house, she has no devices at all. And the reason for that is they have to entertain themselves. After all the pissing and moaning, they had to entertain themselves. And once they were entertaining themselves and they were playing games and they were talking and they were making jokes and, you know, watching telly together rather than apart and talking about it and things like that. And she found that to be very rewarding as well. So I don't think there are any easy answers to it. I just think it's...
No, there's not. There's not.
It's not having enough. So I think having, like, you might binge watch a TV show, which is probably not something that you would do at this stage in your life because you are, because you have children. But when they get a bit older, you will binge watch something with your children and it will be fabulous. You will really, really enjoy it. I do.
It is to do with when you kind of, I don't know, there's so many things just swirling around my head. And, you know, there's the way that you think you're going to parent, and then there's the way that you actually parent. And then there's like your professional life, which is linked to that, like digital literacy stuff and whatever, and stuff that you might recommend in broad brushstrokes. But then you think, well, this is a very specific case, so that doesn't apply. But of course it does, because it's just one instance of a more general thing. And it's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
So I'll give you an example, right? Uh-huh. When you set up, and every kind of device maker does this slightly differently, but on an Amazon tablet, I could set up their tablets in fundamentally like two different ways. The first way you can do it is you can set it up so that it's part of your Amazon household. So they are a child in my household, and they get a different kind of screen to me, and I have to add content to their thing, to their area, you know, one for Ben, one for Grace, etc. They get access to, you know, the books that I've bought and the apps that I've downloaded and everything like that. And I have to be very intentional about the ones that I share. And then there's a web browser which by default blocks, you know, lots of things, etc. So that's one way I could do it. The other way of doing it would be to set up the device as my device, and then you can say that you want, there's like basically parental surveillance mode. So you turn this on, and it can only be turned off with your PIN code. And from that point, when you pass that device over to the kid, then everything that they do is then goes onto your Amazon account, and you can view every single thing that they've done. And I do not want to do that.
I don't. I don't think there's an easy answer to this, is there? I think what's important. I'm trying to think about the psychological principles that underlie all of it from their point of view, rather than from yours.
Yeah.
And so, from the child's point of view, and this isn't looking at you, obviously, it's looking at the relationship. And I do think there is something in the idea. That's what I sense with this boy today. The idea of, if you take freedom away, if you take their autonomy, their choice away, and that you are nurturing a sense of disadvantage or dissatisfaction, or I must go and do this at another time. I must find a way past my parental settings, my parental response to this, and I will one day go and have the time, have the things that I'm missing out on, because there is that sense of, you know, does someone become better at watching, better at eating because they are fed, force-fed an entirely healthy diet, but they're never allowed to go to McDonald's, and they're never allowed to go, you know, have junk food and fast food and whatever, processed food? Or are they a better manager of their own diet as an adult when they are allowed access to those things? They're allowed to try them, but you're talking about them and you're, do you know what I mean?
And well, so a perfect case of this would be alcohol. So the prevailing wisdom as when I was growing up was that middle-class parents especially would give their kids alcohol from quite a young age to get them used to drinking in social situations. Now the advice is, don't do that, because it gets them used to drinking alcohol and it just kind of normalizes the whole thing, and you shouldn't do that. And certainly that's had an effect on my family. I'm not going to go into on this podcast, but like that kind of getting used to drinking alcohol has, you know, caused problems. So, yeah, I think, as you say, it's not easy.
The drugs guy was interesting on this. He talked about alcohol as a drug and nothing else. It was interesting. His father died from alcoholism, and his brother died from a heroin overdose. And so the interesting personal things that he shared with us was one about how he, and he didn't say this explicitly, but he just didn't do it. He just talked about alcohol as a drug. And he talked about, and everyone has just assumed because his brother had died from a heroin overdose, that he was a junkie. And he wasn't. He was not a regular user of heroin. He was not a frequent user of heroin at all. He just took very pure heroin and it killed him. And so that it's an interesting thing, isn't it, that things just aren't simple and straightforward. But there is that's why I think we're going to have drugs will be manufactured, synthetic drugs will be manufactured in the not too distant future, to so that we can control, we can use them like we would a cup of coffee or a glass of wine. We can use them to get the effect that we want on our brain and body without, but in dosages that are really, really manageable and gaugeable, if you like, sort of thing. So I know how many glasses of wine I can have before I play football, which is zero. And do you know what I mean? But I know that I can have a pint or two before I record a podcast. And the podcast might be better for it, you know. Yeah. that kind of thing. And
yeah, I know. And it's learning your limits and stuff, and it's kind of letting go of the reins slowly as a parent.
It is difficult. Like my parents are big drinkers, like, but we weren't allowed to drink, and ever, not even when we were like 17. Do you know what I mean? And the idea of me, you know, when mum found out I'd been in a pub, she went mad. Like, absolutely. That's when I was 16 on New Year's Eve. It's good night, like, but definitely worth the bollocking. But I don't know. But they drank enormously. Every social occasion they participated in involved alcohol. So they just taught me to drink, whether they liked it or not.
Well, exactly. It's do as I do, not as I say.
Yeah. Well, they had a booze cabinet, for Pete's sake. You know what I mean? With like billions of bottles. I used to take a jam jar and just, you know, nick a shot out of every one. Take it down the pond. Yeah,
and, you know, I've told you before, like my early experiences on the internet and how I got on there, you know, nicking my dad's credit card, cancelling the CompuServe agreement at the end of the month in the phone box and the road, and my parents never finding out and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah. It's difficult.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? It's really, I don't, you know, it's not.
Like you want your kids to be appropriately rebellious. It's just really annoying when they are.
They're rebellious on your terms.
Exactly.
Rebel like this.
Oh dear me.
I don't know. So it's a really, really interesting thing, isn't it? Because there is no easy answer to it. And you're right in the struggle right now. So it'll be interesting to see how the tablets come out. But I do think there is a thing about this where you cultivate a sense of angst in your child because you're locking them out of something, because you're not giving them enough. And when the truth is that they could burn, their usage will burn out, you know.
I'd like to think that If it was random, if it was like, yes, you can do this, no, you can't do this, but there was no rhyme or reason to it, then that would be frustrating and annoying. But I'd like to think that they know fine well, like I'd hope they'd be able to predict what their mother and I would see was okay and what wasn't okay.
I don't think you need to use the word hope there. They are absolutely, I haven't met either of them, but I'm sure they're intelligent people and they're just going to be able to completely understand exactly what it is. They'll have you down pat. They'll be experts.
Yeah, like if you came to our house and said, Ben, why aren't you allowed to play Fortnite? I'm sure he'd be able to tell you.
Yeah. Well, I was seated. So our deputy head this week sent a thing through from Northampton County Council saying about a warning about Fortnite and about its addictive behavior, how it encouraged it, but also has massive in-app spendings.
That's the thing. My son spent £16 on FIFA points last week.
Did he?
Yeah, which he gets what? Yeah, he gets a certain amount, then he has to, like, we force him to save 20% and give 10% to charity, which means he has less. So it's basically 2 months pocket money he spent on FIFA points to basically impress his mate when he came over to buy FIFA points and open these virtual packs in front of them. But
awesome.
Yeah. Crazy.
That's exactly what being a child is all about. And yeah. I remember when Isaac wanted money for his ex Microsoft account for his Xbox, or Microsoft Live or Xbox Live or something. And and I was just like, "What, you want 40 quid?" And I'm like, "What for? So you can play computer games?" Well, nah. And he was like, "No, you don't understand. This is what I do. This is what my friends do. This is blah, 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 blah." And I'm like, "But you want 40 of my quid, and I don't have much money, to be honest." Well, I'll pay you the money. Well, go on, pay me the money then, and I'll give you. I'll give it. Do you get into these horrible conversations?
Yeah.
It's quite difficult. I don't know.
I think you're so unfair because they only see other people's families from the outside rather than the inside.
Oh gosh, ain't that the truth?
Yeah. Anyway, what else? We're still in the introduction here. My goodness. This week, my car lease fell through my choice. After being strung along by Toyota, I decided that enough was enough, and we have bought a car. We bought a Volvo V60.
Okay. I do like a good Volvo.
Oh, yes.
And my brother once was an advertiser for Volvos. So he was in the marketing department selling Volvos. And... his dream advert was Volvos. They're big, they're boxy, they're safe.
Right, exactly. So we didn't want to be, after lots of thought, we didn't want to be tied into a 3-year lease.
I got that wrong. Hang on. They're boxy, they're safe, and they're big enough to shag in. That's what Sorry, my memory just let me down there.
Oh, I'm going to have to click the not safe for work button on this podcast now.
carry on. So your lease, yes.
Because we might end up moving abroad or doing something. So yes, we bought one. And I told my wife that on Saturday morning, I told her that we were not buying a car. I wasn't going to change my mind. And there was nothing that she could do to persuade me that we weren't getting a lease. By Saturday afternoon, we bought the car. So that just goes to show you how the relationship works in our household.
Go, Hannah. Awesome. That is part of my past, not my future.
Yes.
Cool. Well done for standing your ground.
Yes. So, Moodle Net stuff. I've obviously been working on that this week. So we ran a community call, which was illustrated by Brian Mothers. So you can go and have a look at that. We've set up a MoodleNet Trello board. So Trello, if you haven't come across this, is like a list-based almost to-do system, but it's a bit more complicated than that, and you can do tagging and Kanban board, etc. And so we're going to use Trello linked to Jira issues. So Jira is like a tracker, like an issue tracker, which you use in development. And Jira and Trello are now owned by Atlassian, and you can link the two together. So the Trello board... it's really nice actually in Trello. What you can do is you can set up your board. You can give different people permission to be able to edit and view it and whatever. I've made this one public. Mael de Borneel, who's the technical architect, has edit permissions, as I think does Martin Dugiamas, who's the CEO. But anyone can view it and anyone can comment as well. So if you come along and see something and think, oh, actually, I wonder if Doug or the team knows about this thing over here, you can just add a link to it or you can comment on it or whatever. You can add suggestions. So looking forward to using that. We're in the middle of our kind of first two-week sprint. And then on Product Hunt, I came across something called Whimsical. And this is really nice. The reason it was on Product Hunt was about its wireframes. So, you know, when you're creating a new product and you want to kind of wireframe it up to see what it would look like, they've just launched that. But I've actually been using it for its flowchart functionality over the last week, just to show what different workflows might look like for the community. So it's very easy to use. It's got lots of icons built in, and I recommend it. It's good.
Cool. Just having a look. Looks good. I like the wireframing. Could be useful in my lessons.
Mm.
Is it free?
It's free for the first certain number of flowcharts, and they give you some sample ones. And if you delete all the content within the sample ones, and you can repurpose those ones as well.
Oh, okay, cool. Makes sense.
It's one of those. So yeah, you could totally use it with, you know, Classful students, get them signed up for an account, and they've got like between 3 and 5, I think, of these flowcharts they can do, or mockups. Right.
Yeah, yeah. Good.
Yeah.
They look good. So, Doug, are you a leader everywhere or nowhere?
Interesting question, Di. So this was an article which Laura Hilliger, hi Laura, if you're listening, brought to my attention via her excellent newsletter. It's a commencement speech by Abby Wambach, who is, she was a US soccer player. I never heard of her, I have to say. And the it was all very empowering towards women at this women-only college. I think Barnard College is the college set up for women who weren't allowed to go to Harvard or something like that. And there's a couple of quotations here. She says, if you're not a leader on the bench, i.e. on the football bench, don't call yourself a leader on the field. You're either a leader everywhere or nowhere.
Okay.
And I wondered what you thought about that.
Well, this is an interesting thing. I don't know. I mean, I play football, so I have a take on this. I don't think... I think it possibly holds more validity in the field of sport than it does elsewhere in life. I think part of my job is not to be a leader everywhere. I would argue as a teacher, I don't think you can't. The point being is you can't have leaders. But I think I am the kind of guy that is just better on as a right hand man. Do you know what I mean? It's just like I'm not interested in being the center of things and that kind of thing. I like to drive stuff. I like to make stuff work for people. I like to do certain things like that. But I like to work as part of a team in that regard. And yeah, so I don't know. So maybe I'm just not a leader anywhere, really, is the truth of it, possibly. I don't know. Maybe it holds water. What do you think?
I was thinking, you know, so Karl Popper, the philosopher, had this kind of falsifiability criterion. He was like, something is only true in science if it can be falsified. So I was trying to think, well, what would be a falsifiability criteria for this? If you said, well, here's an example where somebody is, you'd think they were a leader, you'd point to them and say, yeah, they're a leader. In this situation, they're not exhibiting leader-like qualities. Someone would probably pipe up and say, ah, but they're a true leader because they're allowing other people to step forward. In that situation, the whole thing is bollocks, isn't it? Because if you're either saying they're displaying leadership qualities here, therefore they're a leader, they're not displaying leadership qualities here, therefore they're still a leader because they're allowing other people to lead, then none of it makes sense.
I think this is a really interesting thing. Okay, so without wanting to talk about anything in particular, we've just appointed a head of house for next year from our current lower six. So there are 13 boys in the lower six, and 11 of them applied for the position, which is great. And over the years, they've become a really good year group, and it wasn't obvious they would be such a strong year group when they were younger, and they are. So one of the boys was nailed on for the job and had been for years. And others put forward exceptionally strong applications and wrote very well and in great detail with good ideas and clear thought. And the person that we chose in the end was not the nailed on one, but somebody whom we felt would be... would do the job. Somebody who's focused on the leadership of this place, not the wider school, not other things like that. Somebody who'd already nurtured great relationships amongst their peers, but also in the junior years and things like that. And I think we made a really good choice. But in that process, we discussed boys who've really come on through the years and have been dead naughty and got into lots of trouble, but have, you know, got better and better and better year on year. And one of them in particular was up for discussion in the shortlist, as it were. And we didn't go with him, and I'm very pleased that we didn't. I didn't support that. I didn't think it was okay to reward somebody who had not got it right so many times. And but in another house, where the previous boarding house, it's got a new housemaster in it who's in it, just finishing his first year, and he's appointed someone for next year who was a tutee of mine just for two terms before I left. So I know him quite well, and he was a very naughty boy, and very, very good at sport, but really got his conversations with his peers, adults, whomever, wrong. Was always looking cheeky and trying to make mischief, and he's got it. And the Huzum is cited. He just says he's a leader. That's all he says when anyone's questioning him. He just says he's a leader, and this Huzum is a major from the army, and runs the CCF here. And we have the largest CCF of any school in the country. So it's a difficult thing to say. And so I will watch this boy for his year of leadership and in this senior position and see if he does a good job. And I'm really hoping he did. And I did a lot of work with him about his attitude as he stood in front of people and his choices that he made in his conversation and tried to work on him with him on that. And he did get better, but I haven't had anything to do with him for over a year. So it'll be interesting to see, but whether I don't really believe this thing about you're a leader or you're not. I think leadership can be learned. I think leadership is learned from experience. I don't think you can. I think you can be a good leader with no experience, but it's chancy. I think experience as you take opportunities in life to work with others. I mean, it's really all about teamwork leadership, isn't it?
Well, it depends. Yeah,
service. It's interesting. Leadership is service. That's the thing, I'd say.
My dad, which I've mentioned before, was everywhere when I was younger. He was my deputy head. He was my dad. He was my football manager. And he used to always say, "You're a leader, son." I'd mention, "That's because you're a leader," whatever. And he tried to make me captain of the football team. Now, I was not the best footballer on that team, and I actually declined and vehemently disagreed with him over that decision, because I couldn't see how it would be taken as anything other than nepotism, and I didn't see myself in that capacity amongst my peers. But like you, I see myself often as kind of the right-hand man, and certainly my dad was like that as well. But it's interesting, in certain situations, just following his lead of, in a situation, there'll be some people who wouldn't volunteer or some people who wouldn't speak up. Yet my dad would always do that. And so I've learned, and it's almost, I used to do it in an annoying way. I hope I don't do it such an annoying way now. But I've kind of, made myself more aware that as an increasingly middle-aged white male, I am socially programmed to speak over the top of other people and to kind of use my status and physical presence to not allow other people to speak, even if I'm not doing it on purpose. So with all that said, what leaders should do is to step up when they're needed and to help the whole group move forward. And I think that there's many ways that can happen. You can do the servant leadership approach where, you know, you put yourself last and you're just all about the community. Sometimes it's the benevolent dictator role where you are the figurehead and you are sounding out people's opinions and stuff. But at the end of the day, the book stops with you and you're making the final decision. So there's different models, but I think at the end of the day, it's about moving the whole group forward. And as long as you're moving the whole group forward and everyone's behind you, it kind of doesn't matter what style of leadership it is. It's just leadership, isn't it?
I think so. I'd like to, yes, I agree with that. But I'd like to point out, I have a different sort of take on leadership as service. I don't think that's putting yourself at the bottom of the pile. I think quite often a community, a group of people united by whatever characteristics, want in their leader to be strong and to be seen and all of that sort of thing, but to make decisions, certainly in a school like ours, that is definitely required. But you do want that leader to be in service of the school and in service of the community, but you want them to make strong decisions. You want them to be the figurehead. You want them to be up there. You don't want them to be like always taking the last. You want them to, because as a leader, right? If we put, a big a cake in the middle of a table, and the leader takes the biggest piece, right? That's okay, because then it means what they're telling to all the other people around the table is that you can take the biggest piece. It's okay to serve yourself well, or do you know what I mean? Or maybe not the biggest piece, but the next biggest piece, or something of that sort. And I think it's important to look after yourself. And that's an important message for leaders to say. I will look after myself. I will have nice things. I will be well served myself. Well serviced myself. So
right, so long as it's not like, oh, well, hey, I'm the one who gets the special car parking space, and I'm the one who, you know, like some people.
Yeah, but. But equally you could see how the leader would pick up the plate of cake and pass it around, starting with the least leader-y person, the sort of the minion, if you like, or the lowest in the hierarchy or whatever's going on at the table, but starting somewhere and handing the cake around before they take their piece at the end. You can also see how that works, but I think it works on both ways. It's kind of like the point is, let's eat cake and let's have a good time.
It's all about the cake.
Well, yeah, but I think as a leader, it's important to show that. It's like, whilst you are in service of a community, you are also there to enjoy that community and to be part of that community. I think these things are really, really important.
Okay, but we do put kind of signals out there. And I think that one of the things that we do, and I find this hilarious, right? So as you know, and as you can see when we have the video switched on, my hair is now getting extremely gray, and I've been going gray since I was 22. So I'm 37 now, and you know, I'm getting quite gray. Really interesting thing has happened as I've become more gray. People seem, and it might just be more experience as well or whatever, but people are much more likely to weigh my opinion as being one that has some kind of weight.
Yeah, I don't
find that hilarious, because I feel like I'm saying the same stuff as I've always said.
Well, I think that's an interesting way, right? So there are so many variables at play there, and your hair is only one of them. It's impossible to tell whether that is your hair or not.
Okay, well, what I mean is, like, you look like you're older. You look like you're like a middle-aged white guy, and therefore, to my mind, it feels like that kind of default mode of like, oh, well, he must know what he's talking about kind of plays in, which I find absolute bollocks.
Yeah. Well, I'd say cosmetically speaking, people are not taken on their words. That's a definite thing. People are judged by their appearance. I'd say when you had your crew cut, so you were pepper-headed, you're going to get a better reaction with your hair as it is now than you were then, you know, whether it's gray or red or whatever. Just because there's something about that, which is, a little bit difficult when you're meeting people that you don't know very well, and people don't know you very well, more to the point, is that they will judge you by these cosmetic, aesthetic, whatever's characteristics. And I think
what I'm trying to get to that is that there's like, you can almost hack the system. So, you know, when you read all of these books, like Tim Ferriss's books or whatever, about like how to hack the system or how to be a growth hacker or do whatever, there's certain cultural cues that people use. And it's really interesting when you're shopping around for cars, how car salesmen do this. Like, they'll always have a very nicely ironed shirt and a jacket. They'll all give you a firm handshake and have the big watch on and all that kind of stuff. And these are all just like well-worn proxies for you being able to have confidence in them. Yeah, they'll have the thank you card on the desk from a, you know, a, in scare quotes, satisfied customer, all that kind of stuff. But I'm really interested in how other cultures and other groups do that, because I feel like the middle-aged white guy approach to leadership hasn't been all that awesome in the 21st century.
No, I think it's... I think that's a really difficult thing. I think society is... Is it gently untwisting itself back to some kind of natural state of equality? I don't know, but certainly where it comes from was distorted and twisted, in my opinion, in all kinds of manner of massive prejudices, one being gender, one being race, particularly those two, particularly, and it is unwinding back to a sort of natural place where that sort of thing is mattering less and less and less. And we're getting away from this fastidious place of you must be dressed in a certain way and you must be this, that, and the other. I certainly wear a uniform. I wear it quite deliberately to work, and I look smart, and I'm always clean shaven, and I wear a waistcoat all of the time, no matter how hot it is, because that's how I dress. And no shoes. but if I, you know, I'll put a suit on, and people will say, "Have you got a new suit?" No, it's 3 years old, and I've worn it loads. It's like really, but people have a perception that I am smart, and that's a perception I am managing by dressing in the way that I do, the same way that the car salesman would be.
I just find it strange that we have to. Yeah, I suppose it's a natural kind of thing. But I'm talking about kind of history and natural things. There was a really long but very interesting article, which was linked to you by a guy called Dugald Hine. Now, I think I've mentioned Dugald Hine before, because I was going to go to his crazy summer school thing in the wilds of Sweden at the start of this month, I couldn't make it for logistical reasons. But I was reading his blog after not having read it for a while, and he links to an article by David Graeber and David Wengrow. Now, David Graeber, I think, is the same person who has recently written a book, but also a famous article about bullshit jobs, which we've talked about in this podcast before. Mm-hmm. And the general gist of it is, and, you know, it is written in a pretty left-leaning magazine or website, and, it, you know, it has definitely a slant, as everything does. But the main point that they're trying to make is that we have this view of human history that things used to be, before people got into civilized society, there were hunter-gatherers, and these people were in a state of anarchy, moving around the place, and that once we settled down, there were lots of problems which came with that in terms of, you know, inequality and whatever, and hierarchical societies. But almost that's the price that you have to pay for living in a civilized society. Like, if you don't do that, if we don't have hierarchical societies which are unequal, then we're going to go back to kind of anarchic hunter-gatherer times, and we don't want that, do we? And they kind of slowly pick apart this kind of implicit argument, saying that actually there's a lot of evidence to show that these societies weren't anarchic at all, and that there was a lot of cooperation, and that actually they were quite civilized in any way that you want to describe it, so that it's not a choice between anarchy in the way that it's usually conceptualized or hierarchical society, which is unequal. Like, we can have more equal cooperative societies without kind of going back to the Stone Age, is kind of the main gist.
Okay, I think that's it's hard to unpack.
Well, the particular thing I'm interested in is the ways of structuring organizations and societies. And there's a bit at the end where they talk. They say, I'll just read this quote. He says, "As Claude Levi Strauss often pointed out, early Homo sapiens were not just physically the same as modern humans; they were our intellectual peers as well. In fact, most were probably more conscious of society's potential than people generally are today, switching back and forth between different forms of organization every year. Rather than idling in some primordial innocence until the genie of inequality was somehow uncorked, our prehistoric ancestors seem to have successfully opened and shut the bottle on a regular basis, confining inequality to ritual costume dramas, constructing gods and kingdoms as they did their monuments, then cheerfully disassembling them once again. If so, then the real question is not, what are the origins of social inequality? But having lived so much of our history moving back and forth between different political systems, how did we get so stuck?" End of quote.
How did we?
Now, as I've kind of said before, if you go to the company in the UK, if you go to the company's house website, and you click on the button that says, you know, set up a limited company. You can set up a limited company right now in about 10 clicks without having to have very much information to hand. And that's because there is a default model of how we do things. If you want to set up a co-op, it's going to take a lot of thought, a lot of understanding how things work, and a great deal of time and effort. And again, there's a reason for that. And there's a, you know, it could be just as easy to set up a co-op, but it's not. And so there's a default model to our society. There's a default way it's organized. There's a default hierarchy to it. And I guess this is just very gently unpicking some of that in a very nuanced way.
Which, so they're nudges, basically, aren't they? So the way that things are easy, you know, things that are easy to do are you're being nudged in the direction of doing that. If something's difficult, like the co-op, you're being nudged away from doing that without you actually being aware of that. And society is full of lots of nudges in that regard, I think. And it's an interesting thing because these things get put in place over generations of development, one would say, rather than evolution. And they are, that development is defined by people looking after their own kind of thing, protecting their position, confirmation bias, all you know, just putting laws in place, rules in place within organizations and within societies that allow themselves at younger years to succeed and do well, sort of thing. The people that protect their incomes more explicitly than anyone else you see are the people who didn't go through the education system, you know, the sort of Donald Trump, Richard Branson, Alan Sugar, I'm thinking, type of people. But the real power in theory is held within the elite education system and and then up through Oxford and Cambridge.
Well, I guess something has to play the main role in society. Historically, it's been religion. Right now, it's the economy. And they even kind of take to task the whole notion of inequality because it's always described in financial terms. So here's another quotation. He says, inequality is a way of framing social problems appropriate to technocratic reformers, the kind of people who assume from the outset that any real vision of social transformation has long since been taken off the political table. It allows one to tinker with the numbers, argue about Gini coefficients and thresholds of dysfunction, readjust tax regimes or social welfare mechanisms, even shock the public with figures showing just how bad things have become. Can you imagine 0.1% of the world's population controls over 50% of the wealth? All without addressing any of the factors that people actually object to about such unequal social arrangements. For instance, that some manage to turn their wealth into power over others, or that people end up being told their needs are not important and their lives have no intrinsic worth. The latter, we are supposed to believe, is just the inevitable effect of inequality. An inequality, the inevitable result of living in any large, complex, urban, technologically sophisticated society. End of quote.
Okay, so what this is saying is that what's on offer, which is that last sentence, is not all that is possible.
Right, right.
And there is a different way of life that no one has ever achieved.
Not that no one's ever achieved, just that we seem to have forgotten about it. So in the same way that, you know, when you're born in a certain time period and the world or nature is such, there's a phrase for this, I've forgotten what it is. But, you know, you were born at a certain time, I was born at a certain time. At that point, nature had been degraded by humans to a greater or lesser extent. And so we see that as ground zero from what we want to protect. But when you do some reading about how flourishing nature used to be, for example, that's the wrong baseline to go from. And it's similar here in terms of the way that we structure societies. Like, we're so far from how things could be in terms of cooperation. And I can't help but think that some of the anxiety that people feel, some of the, you know, bullshit jobs, etc., are a result of this default mode of operating, which doesn't really fit the majority of humankind.
Yes, I agree. And it's so, and I think, so you talked about the move away from religion being the sort of central the centrifuge of society towards economics being the centrifuge of society, and economics is all about the movement of money around society, and it is therefore about people's means of income earning and production and things, and that's an important. It's an important thing, really. I mean, what governance is all about now is the people's quality of life, the standard of living, and how that is changing. And society is naturally unequal, but there is definitely a sense of earning a lot of money is what you want to do. And that sense is out there, and that sense is perpetuated by all the sorts of things that we like to do, like watching television and going on holiday and, you know, and going to see, and celebrity culture. Celebrity culture is a real, something I'm not a big fan of. I think and deserves more scrutiny than it gets. And distorts. I mean, I just feel very Marxist and a big fan of Marx generally. But you just feel, you know, about the, and we've talked about sport before being the opium of the masses and keeping people's emotional or anger, if you like, at their situations at bay, at the inequality and the injustices that exist in society. People are directing their tribal sense of justice through sport. But sport is just a massive entertainment industry, which is no different to Love Island, really. Possibly has more integrity to it, but possibly not. And that whereas sitting at home watching a sport on the television, like going to watch it happen live, seems like a sensible activity to do, but not as sensible as playing it, and watching it at home. Like we're all going to watch the World Cup as it comes around, and the World Cup's a little bit different because it's geographically isolated, I guess, and the television allows us to participate in it or feel like we are. But what you're getting is this massive sense of occasion, a sense of bridges across nations, and all of that. And really, what is that serving? We're just going to have a month of fun in the summer watching football. And thinking that we care about it and it's important in any way, shape, or form. And whereas it will serve some important purposes to do with diplomacy between nations, I guess, doesn't actually serve anything, really. it's just rubbish.
Well,
it is. I mean, I love it and I'll really enjoy watching it, but it's meaningless. You know, I'd much rather see the resources that are put into the World Cup being put into dealing with people who have a very poor standard of living and helping them in the
world.
Yeah,
that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because and also the choice of location for the World Cups, etc. But I have seen or heard in conversation some people make almost like a utilitarian argument about, well, these kinds of things, Eurovision Song Contest, the FIFA World Cup, the Olympics, whatever, the Commonwealth Games, like they cost a lot of money to put on, but in terms of like net human happiness, I don't know.
Well, I mean, and there are lots of fantastic stories that happen when these events occur, but it's, and that is real, but they're only meaningful in the backdrop of what a society existing as it exists. I mean, that, you know, they are a device that are useful in that regard. So, but you know, is South Africa any better for having hosted the World Cup 4 years ago? Is London any better for having hosted the Olympics? I don't know. Are we doing anyone any favors really with this stuff? Is it only right and sensible that we should see who can run the fastest in the whole world? Does that matter in a world of 7 billion people when some people can't get any food? Are these things so abstract from each other that they're just entirely unrelated, and therefore don't affect each other at all? Well, I don't know. So our conversation becomes null and void, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it's a really difficult thing, and I often wonder this: is society getting better?
Well, this is, you know, I was mentioning the book I read I finished reading yesterday or the day before, Adam Greenfield's Radical Technologies. He was talking about how we no longer use the word progress. We use the word innovation, and they're two very different things.
Yes, yeah, we discussed this in detail last week. It was the name of last week's podcast, in fact, wasn't it? And we did establish that. So in the teacher dichotomy of traditional versus progressive, I think it's really it does everyone a disservice, and because being progressive just means you make progress from the point at which you are, and you're just building on something. It doesn't mean you're doing it in a particular way. And innovation should be the word that is. Traditional versus innovative is really what that dichotomy is. And if it is a dichotomy, because well, it has to be, because you become progressive if you adopt innovation. And you and I think we're firmly agreed on the idea that innovation requires great caution and scrutiny before it is adopted, and that's where things fall down often.
No, absolutely. And there's a whole kind of thing to unpack there, but I'm interested in moving on, actually, and looking at the... I haven't read it because it's a long interview, but there's a guy whose surname you're going to expertly pronounce, I'm sure, who...
I am going to say. Yeah. So Siva Vaid Hayanathan.
Very good.
Vaid Hayanathan.
An interview entitled The Zuckerberg Follies. So what's this about in The Baffler?
Okay, well, so I read this... the other morning. I don't think I quite finished it. It's a lengthy piece, but I was close. But I was really impressed with the way this gentleman is talking about Facebook in particular, but social media in general. He's just published a book called Anti-Social Media, in his new book. So he's obviously advertising that, and his interview is a means of doing that. He's doing the rounds with it, I guess. But he just says some really, really nice things. So I think he was the one that ditched the idea of addictive behavior and talked about habituating stuff. But one of the things that, like phones, habituate you. They form habits in you, and you just need to be aware of that. But one of the things I liked is the way he talked about. Oh, here we go. So let me do a little bit of quoting. So really, I haven't got time to discuss this whole article, and you need to read it as well in its fullness, I think, before we can discuss it properly. But it would be really good if anyone listening were interested that they went and read it. So, okay. One person recently told me with apparent satisfaction, this is the interviewer, "I've been Facebook sober for almost a year now." And the response of Savvy is, "And you know what? I applaud that. I think if something is bad for you personally, by all means, get away from it. But Facebook brings value and satisfaction to more than 2 billion people. They're not all fools. They're not all dupes. And although they often are addicted, or habituated is a better word, right? However, I take breaks from Facebook as well. I have 30 days. I take 30-day, 60-day breaks to get steady, to pull back from the noise and the turmoil, often to finish a writing project. But no one should pretend that those are political acts. And this is my larger point here. To be political is to be engaged, to have a stake. To remove yourself from having a stake is to be apolitical. Facebook demands political responses. And these, I hate to even use the word boycotts, these soft individualistic removals or recusals are not boycotts. They're not politically organized. They're not intended to deny a powerful force something valuable in a systematic way. They don't really put pressure on anybody who matters. They're simply self-satisfying moves. They're acts of moral indignation and not relevant political actions." Which I thought was kind of powerful, really.
Well, you see...
Because I've kind of dumped Facebook, and it's
And he tweeted the whole article, and I don't know this guy, so I don't know where he's coming from. I think it's always important to know someone's worldview and not just take their statements in isolation. But with all that said, like, the feminist movement says that the personal is political. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you make a personal decision based on your values, and you decide to remove yourself from a particular situation, that is a political statement.
Yes, I think it is within your political arena, as in your personal life.
Right. But it's, so he says, To be political is to be engaged, to have a stake. To remove yourself from having a stake is to be apolitical. Well, I think I can talk about the broader landscape in which Facebook operates, and I can condemn Facebook for their actions without being a Facebook user.
I think that's true, but one might, yes, but again, I would argue that's in your smaller life. So when you're looking at, as in within your immediate life, when you're, because as you say, it's about, you can condemn them and you have your reach.
But he's almost saying, isn't he, that you can only criticize Facebook inside Facebook, or you can only criticize Twitter inside Twitter, which is not true.
I think it's not true, but I think you can't. So, what Facebook did was appalling. But if I criticize Facebook for, say, the Cambridge Analytica thing and what it does with that in that regard, and I'm criticizing for that, and I say, well, I deleted my Facebook account for that purpose, but I'm not on Facebook, so I don't know how Facebook is dealing with that and how it's changing and what it's doing at this moment. I haven't used it for a couple of months or whatever. And it might not change, it might be exactly the same. But my argument then becomes not part of that. It's a bit like saying, if you don't vote, you don't have a say on who's running your government. There's no point you criticizing it, and your abstention from voting is not a vote. It's, you're just not participating. It's apolitical. It's not a political comment.
Not voting is a political action, though.
How is it? Why is it?
Because he seems to be conflating politics with democracy, which are not the same thing at all.
No, I don't think it's fair to say he's saying that. I think I'm saying that in my
notes. All right, okay. You're saying the politics is the same as
us. I'm just trying to sort of explore what he's saying.
Okay.
But, yeah, so... But anyway, I think it's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's the idea that it's to not participate in these things. So it's an interesting point, isn't it? So do you think that Facebook is going to be here in 15 years' time?
Yes, in the same way that Yahoo has been here in 15 years' time.
So you think it will flop? Because I think Facebook's got a much more secure hold on the world than Yahoo ever did, personally.
Can you remember how much of a behemoth AOL and Yahoo were back in the day?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it didn't last that long.
MySpace, like, nobody thought Facebook was going to be a thing. Everyone thought that MySpace was going to be a thing back in 2005.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, it is in terms of megacorps and vertical integration, all that kind of stuff. I agree.
Yeah, and it's global spread as well. I mean, it's like it's kind of huge. It's taken a massive hold. Anyway, so
but, you know, hey, the British Empire. You know, like all these things just
will fall away.
Yeah. But I do like what he says. Maybe this is me reading into it. But if I say to you and people listening to this, like, don't think of the color blue. It's the first thing that pops into your head. And so in order to make you not think of the color blue, I should make you think about a different color, like red or yellow or green or something like that. And it's the same with Facebook. Let's stop talking about Facebook. If you want to get rid of Facebook, instead of having campaigns about delete Facebook, let's provide options for people to go elsewhere and do all the things that they were previously doing on Facebook.
I'd buy that. I'm not about to reopen my account. I don't miss it. He does some lovely things, though. So what else does he do that is really good in here? So I often tell my students The Social Network is like a cartoon. This is the film, The Social Network. The Zuckerberg character in The Social Network is not Zuckerberg. Jesse Eisenberg's portrayal of the character is flat. It's motivated by merely resentment and envy, the character, and that's not Mark Zuckerberg. Mark Zuckerberg is an evangelist. He's deeply committed and has always been deeply committed to an ideology of global uplift through digital connectivity. It's interesting. He's batting for Zuckerberg here, isn't he? He's never deviated from this position. He has seen his members or his Facebook users instrumentally, right? I don't know what that means. So he is never seen as full human beings. Or he sees people as Facebook users. He sees us as producers of data. He wants us to be happy the way that someone might want a cage full of gerbils to be happy. I love that. And he also talks about he compares Donald Trump's election to Barack Obama's election and say that they use the same tools. They just use them in different ways. So he talks about Obama and Trump use Facebook very differently. By the time Trump came along, Facebook was no longer letting campaigns have this data, the stuff that Barack Obama took. Facebook decided to take it all in-house and do it all for them. And this is why I don't think Cambridge Analytica mattered to the Trump at all to the Trump campaign. Trump didn't need Cambridge Analytica to profile American voters. Facebook did it for him. What happened in 2015 was that Facebook decided we will no longer share the data outside of Facebook. We're going to hold it for ourselves and we're going to create our own political consulting business. And that's what it did. So in 2016, Facebook embedded Facebook employees with major campaigns around the world, embedded people in the campaign of Narendra Modi in India. In early 2016, it embedded people in the campaign of Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines. Mid to late 2016, it embedded people in its campaigns of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Difference was Clinton's campaign was run by political professionals who thought they knew everything. They relied on conventional wisdom, all the sets of data, and the Democratic National Committee and the Obama campaign had given them. And blah, 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 blah. You get the idea. So it's really interesting in that regard as well. This guy's, he's worth reading is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, although just when you mentioned that bit after the way it's portrayed about community, because I saw the word community referenced a lot in a short period of time. And the guy's saying that we shouldn't have allowed Facebook to buy Instagram. We definitely shouldn't have allowed Facebook to buy WhatsApp. There should be some kind of antitrust laws, etc. But I really like the fact that he zeroes in on community. So he says, and Zuckerberg continues to use words like community, a word that he does not understand in the least. This is what I mean when I say he's uneducated, because he keeps using terms like community, which are complex, fraught concepts, and he doesn't stop to think about what that means. He doesn't stop to think about the dynamics of a community, the effects of a community, the limitations of a community, and even the very definition of a community. You know, if someone's going to use community as the core goal of a multi-billion dollar company, maybe a couple of days reading would help. End of quote. I like that.
Exactly. So this is the thing. It's quite interesting, isn't it? So he's clearly, he is in an interview and he's trying to sell his book and he is trying to put food on his table, as it were. And he is clearly batting against the anti-Facebook movement, if you like, and he's working in the web so that the people he wants to read his book are these people. So he's trying to draw their attention in and creating his own propaganda, if you like. But he also has this, certain sense about it, like the stuff you just quoted is that he's scrutinizing these things, he's looking at it and he's trying to analyze.
Looks good. So what's the name of the book that he's peddling?
Anti-social media,
how Facebook disconnects us and undermines democracy. Okay.
Which is a very sort of popular thing. But this book was written prior to the Cambridge Analytica situation.
Okay. Well, interestingly, I didn't watch any of the Apple keynotes and stuff, but I saw them referenced in different places. And apparently, so Apple, for those listening, does this WWDC, the Worldwide Developers Conference. And it's it gets all their developers together and the community of developers, but it also gives them a chance to announce new things like iOS 12. And from what I understand, Tim Cook stood on stage or whoever it was and talked about how they're doubling down on privacy because privacy is a human right, they were saying. And they talked about removing or blocking the like button in Safari and explicitly put screenshots of Facebook on there, which I don't think big corporates like Google and Apple and Facebook, they don't usually attack each other so obviously, do they?
No, they don't. And it's that was notable, is that Tim Cook, they clearly made a corporate a decision to distance themselves from Facebook, to use the WWDC to do so. I don't know what consequences that will have for them. Okay, it's past the 10 o'clock hour. What didn't we get to?
So there was some stuff on quite a technical one on how blockchain was just a stepping stone, because blockchain is now using so much electricity, et cetera, et cetera. There's other ways of doing decentralized, consensus, which solves the Byzantine generals problem. So Parsec is a new protocol from the people behind Made Safe. I'll stick the link in there. I wrote something about not using GitHub and using other things like GitLab and some of the problems behind that. There was a really interesting thing.
Why would you not want to use GitHub?
Sorry, go on.
Why would you not want to use GitHub?
Well, it's owned by Microsoft, and there's some things which came out of that. You know, it's always a bad idea to centralize open source development on something which isn't itself open source. But it doesn't actually store. So for those who don't know what GitHub is, it's a place in which you can store code, and Git itself, for British people, sounds slightly rude, but is just a version control system. So make sure that people who are working on a project in terms of code don't clash when they try and merge files, etc. So GitHub doesn't actually store code in Git repositories themselves. Like it stores them in this proprietary format, which is why it's so hard to get off there. But there are exporting tools, and I've written on that. Really interesting one on where memes come from, which I'm a bit sad that we didn't get to, which was talking about how actually when it comes to memes going viral, it's just literally you need to make lots and lots of them and see what happens. And this particular article from MIT Technology Review goes into some of the most popular places for memes, especially political ones like the Donald and a subreddit called Politics. And I just saw actually while we were meeting and I was on Hacker News, there is on CryptoList, which is a job site for people interested in crypto, there is a meme specialist job opening. It's one of those jobs that didn't exist yet that we keep being told about.
Okay.
What else have we got on there?
Well, we have more about memes. So copyright law is being reviewed at the moment and is going to change, but people are campaigning against it because it is going to affect, because memes essentially take copyrighted media and rehash it, and that it's going to affect that. So AI will go and hunt down memes on the internet, and if it can identify that you used a copyright image, it will remove it. So it's a bit like Google's use of in YouTube, finding music, for example, it's copyrighted and it takes the music off your thing, and it's all done by computers. So that's something worth reading about. And then you put an article about Boing Boing from Boing Boing in there where, is it Cory Doctorow, you said, is talking about that copyright law?
Sorry, which one was that?
The Boing Boing one.
Yeah, so this is just referencing the BBC article, just saying that it's there's a particular part of the EU's new copyright directive, Article 13, and that the idea is that in the same way that YouTube's content ID matches things and kind of enforces copyright, that would work across the entire web, which obviously is bad news for memes.
So, and then finally, there was an interesting thing that I saw through, I can't remember where I saw it through now. I think I saw it through the EFF notification. But Google have, on the 7th of June, published 7 principles that guide their AI development, their artificial intelligence development. And they are quite, so we don't have time, so they are quite simply, 1, be socially beneficial.
2, avoid creating or reinforcing unfair bias.
3, be built and tested for safety.
4, be accountable to people.
5, incorporate privacy design principles.
6, uphold high standards of scientific excellence.
And 7, be made available for uses that accord with these principles.
And it's interesting that they also have a section on AI applications we will not pursue, given all of the controversy about how they were helping the US, was it US military, I think?
I don't know. So they talk about they will not pursue technologies that that cause or are likely to cause overall harm. They will not.
But just look at the way that they've couched that. Where there is a material risk of harm, we will proceed only where we believe that the benefits substantially outweigh the risks and will incorporate appropriate safety constraints. That basically, we'll do whatever we want.
Yeah, we'll talk to Donald Trump before we make any big decisions. Mm.
The second one is weapons or other technologies whose principal purpose or implementation is to cause or directly facilitate injury to people.
That's more
That's more, yeah, direct. Yeah.
Number three is technologies that gather or use information for surveillance, violating internationally accepted norms.
What is an internationally accepted norm? Anyway,
well, that's what I would...
number four, technologies whose purpose contravenes widely accepted principles of international law and human rights.
Okay, so the message there to the world from Tide Podcast is sort your laws out in all countries. And and then Google will do good things, not bad things, they say. Yeah. Cool. Okay, what are you up to in this week coming?
This week coming, I'm at home again, which so third week in a row, which is good. FIFA World Cup starts, so I'll be starting to watch that. It's the Scouts AGM. Just working on MoodleNet stuff, really. A couple of other things on the bubbling away on the co-op side of things, but yeah, just nice to be at home for a bit, and the weather's turning nicer. What about you?
I've got lots of meetings at the moment discussing things for next year. Meeting about digital detox on Thursday, which will be interesting. I kind of want to go for the whole analog teaching week, so that people can appreciate where digital is beneficial. But that's quite a big move. I don't know if I'll get that through. What else am I doing? Building resources for surfaces and stuff, writing a scheme of work for Key Stage 3, incorporating computer science and digital literacy. So computer science is the content, digital literacy is as the vehicle, if you like. What else am I doing? Saying goodbye to people, I guess, doing all the sort of farewells. So one of our fifth form pupils left, never to return to the school today. Finished his GCSEs and he's going to a different school for sixth form performing arts. Okay. So doing all that kind of thing as well. So making sure I have nice times with people who I've developed relationships with over a few years.
Cool. Good. Right. Well, thank you very much to everybody who has joined us this far. That's been Tide episode 104, and we'll see you next week.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Watching the tide roll away.